I don't want to lose good candidates because I asked the machine to look at the CVs.
Yes.
Similarly, talking to my customers, I want my customers to have a great experience. What I don't want to do is have people put the phone down right away because they realize they're talking to a bot. But there's other things we can do there to assist people. And so I try and move us away from like just that straight up cost cutting measure to thinking about, like, you know, strategically.
Welcome to the AI Advantage, where modern leaders decode the future of tech. I'm Solomon Williams, founder of Solenox. So here, it's no noise, no hype every week. Sometimes it's just me, and sometimes it's the brightest minds in tech, breaking down what it really takes to grow smarter with AI and automation. Let's dive in.
Welcome to AI Advantage. I'm your host, Solomon Williams. So we have a special guest here. We have Dr. Alex Lathard. So Alex, thank you so much for coming on. So Alex here is has an independent consulting working with data and with AI and with the major shifts that have been going on with continuously through the market. His insight's going to be great. So Alex, thanks again for coming on to the show. How are you?
No problem, Solomon. I'm good, thanks. I think I'm one of the few Britons who weren't massively disappointed by the football last night.
Yes, I know. I know. I was hoping to have it to where England would be able to beat down Argentina to kind of showcase, but
I think when it comes to sport, I'm used to disappointment with England at this point. So.
I know. Hopefully on the next FIFA, but I'm excited, man. So for the audience that's coming through here, can you tell us like a little bit about when did you start getting into the AI space and, you know, what have you seen thus far? Can you just walk us through a little bit of your career?
I'd love to. Thank you. So I've had what I describe as a really wiggly career. I started out in civil engineering, you know, quite a traditional background, but didn't enjoy being a civil engineer in practice. Did a PhD in climate change impact analysis. So doing lots of modeling around things like climate, weather, rivers, reservoirs, connecting those things together and how they flow. That required working with huge amounts of data, very complex data sets. If you know anything about the history of complexity and data, you know that a lot of it starts with weather modeling. And so I really cut my teeth working with the sorts of tools that we now sort of call AI. So computational statistics, big compute grids of sort of thousands of nodes, code that I was writing myself and deploying to that, running statistical models, bringing the results back and optimizing. So a really sort of early version of what people would call ML ops and AI these days. From there, I really wanted to improve my business acumen. So joined a big consultancy, you know, big four consultancy doing things like fraud analytics for governments on other continents and tier one banks in the UK and things like that. And then since then, I've been working as, I think I would term it as a CDO or a CTO de facto. So being responsible for things like data, technology, AI within an organization, and then also doing consulting on the back of that. So working with a really broad variety of businesses. It could be anything from marketing, business intelligence, financial services. I touch all sorts of different things where there are the same sorts of pain points around accessing data, cleaning data, applying AI models to it reliably, and making the insights that come out of those to be of value to people.
Yeah. So I'm curious because you've had such an interesting career from coming from on the civil engineering side to now moving on to AI, and now it's just a different kind of format, but you're still doing the modeling. You're a lot with, especially on your consulting. So I'm really curious as you now you're going more on the leadership front. How is it from what you've seen with dealing from banking and from all these compliance heavy to different industries? What is the leadership really saying in terms of the data that they're seeing and how is it shifting? How do you go about that on how industries should be properly hygiening their data? Does that make sense?
I think so. So from my perspective, I mean, I ended up working with leadership teams and in leadership positions because I was working as like a delivery lead in organizations. And what I found very quickly was there was a huge bottleneck. There was a huge translation problem between what the top end leadership of the organization thought they were going to get, thought was happening, and what actually was feasible and possible on the ground. So the gap there was enormous. And as a delivery person, I was constantly firefighting, trying to keep up with that gap.
Yeah.
And so as part of my role in sort of building and supporting teams and helping other people with their careers, I thought, well, one of the most important things I need to do is elevate myself into that sort of position. so that I can start helping to set the agenda, to helping to start align and get clarity in the leadership team and listen to what people are saying and resolve the challenges and the problems and the friends that are there so that the delivery people can get on and actually do some really great work. And so for things like AI, the challenges are really similar to what we were seeing with data maybe 15 years ago, because I think lots of organizations are understandably completely activated and energized by the grand promise of AI. You know, we've all been told how fantastic and revolutionary this technology either is or is very soon going to be. And lots of people have bought into the idea that I can chuck any old data into this bucket and get incredible insights out of it that are going to, you know, completely change the profitability of my business. And trying to unpick that with people and say, well, we still need to understand what are the questions we want to answer, because ultimately this is a tool, but we have to furnish it. We have to construct it in the right way. We have to integrate it in the right way. We have to know how to put information into it and how to interpret the information that comes out. So if we don't do that in the right context with the right tissue of connectivity, we could just be accelerating bad insights, if you like.
You know, I'm curious because with you, because I've been in the consulting realm as well, and tell me if I'm wrong, what your thoughts on it. And, you know, with you being the delivery lead and now you're coming into more of an executive view front, do you feel like AI has shifted in terms of, because the most important thing as consultant is those discovery questions, right? Of coming in, asking the right questions, and then you have to break that down to talking to the subject matter experts from each department, right? So from applications to databases. So do you feel that AI has, from the clients that you've worked with, has that shifted into the questions? Have you seen a decrease? Has it been more questions? Like, what are you thinking?
Questions from the client around things? No, those haven't necessarily changed, because the sort of level of engagement is very much around, I've got this pain point, I would like you to come in and take away my pain. They don't necessarily seem to be any differently informed about that pain point. So a concrete example that comes up for me all the time is things like, we have bought Databricks, we have had a consultant come in and deploy this for us. Why isn't it singing and dancing and just completely enabling us in all the ways that we were promised?
Yes.
It's not like people have then taken the initiative to dive into and use an AI tool like an LLM to try and ask and answer those questions for themselves. So I wouldn't say I'm getting a different level of challenge around those questions. Where it has helped me quite a lot is I'm already quite a generalist. You know, I've worked in lots of different parts of organizations. I've led different parts of organizations. I've had my fingers in ops and HR and legal, not just tech. I get involved with product. I get involved with finance. When you're the head of data, you touch everything usually. But what I like about these things is I can come up with schemas of questions. I can come up with processes. And then it's like having an extra two or three brains to run ideas past. So I'm just that little bit further ahead when I do go to a client and say, this is what I've abstracted from what we've discussed. How does this look to you? I may be already one or two iterations deep into that. And of course, you have to be a little bit careful about over-optimizing too early. But I find that it's not unusual to find maybe one or two angles I haven't thought about yet.
You know, the reason why I asked that, because I know, and one of your really strongest views was that there's a rush to adopt this narrative on AI. And I think that, you know, because of that rush, because of not taking the necessary steps of doing, you know, discovery, asking, you know, exactly to your point of data warehousing for data lake stored and of how they're building it out, there that there might be gaps, or they're thinking that it's a much quicker process to get this in within at the end of the quarter for the project to showcase some sort of eye on that side. Why is it there's still that disconnect? As you think that the market is shifting back into seeing that, you know, there that promise of what you said, that what AI can do to bring it back to what really, what's the pain point that we're solving, instead of this grand scheme of it can do it all? Or what? I'm curious on that.
Yes. So I was talking about this with a contact today about, are we sort of well into the trough of disillusionment, if you like? If you think about it on the sort of Gartner wave, the hype down into the trough of disillusionment, and then gradually we start to find practical uses with real tangible value from a technology. And I think the early adopters are now sort of getting down into that trough, and they're starting to find, actually, maybe this isn't capable of solving all the problems we thought it was. Maybe we do have to do the hard yards on cleaning up and integrating our data, or extracting features, or whatever it is. And that's just the technical side of things. So the bigger area that I think is yet to be addressed, and it's the same issue we had with the sort of big data revolution, and it's the same issue we had with the digital revolution sort of 15 years ago, is the culture of organizations and how they think about investments. And so I think everybody has this sort of, you know, we might phrase it as bet everything on red. We see a technology, we're told it's going to solve all our problems, so we put all of our resources on it. But we don't necessarily think about, well, what are the actual assumptions and hypotheses that we're making here? Can we spell those out in ways that we can measure? And so when we start to do work with AI or big data or whatever it is, can we then start to see the needle move in small but, you know, meaningful ways across our organization and our operations and our customers? And so we work on, you know, we work on doing more of the things that work, and we do less of the things that don't work. And we gradually sort of navigate our way towards, you know, a better future. And I think sort of culturally, lots of organizations are just not there with that type of approach. I think, you know, we see a real disconnect, especially at the exec level as well, around what is your corporate strategy? You know, not just in terms of we would like to be more profitable this year. Everybody would like to be more profitable this year. Tell me something I don't know. And then you start driving that and people go, well, I'd like to be between 3% and 5% more profitable. Okay. Let's talk about why we think that's a good goal and what we would do with it if we were 3% to 5% more profitable. What makes you think that's possible? What are the signals that you've seen in the business? What can we go and test to see is that actually feasible or not? Because when you start to pull those threads, that's when you start to expose things like, because I think AI adoption is going to reduce cost in this part of the business, or it's going to improve productivity in this part of the business. Great. How would we see that materialized? What signals are we going to see? What needles are going to move? Are we measuring those things? If we're not, we need to. And if we find that our expectations are not met within a time frame, a quarter, two quarters, what are we going to do differently? And I feel, you know, my experience is,
yeah,
lots of organizations are just not in that frame of operation.
So where did they start? Because that's a good point that you brought up, Alex. So two questions is, do you think it's in terms of focusing on two or three metrics that they should have for that a key initiative to see, okay, this is going to be on FinOps, you know, on the cost perspective, this is what we should see over, should they break it down to more of a longer term stretch of to see the cost going up? And that second question for you is really just where do you start for someone listening in, for a C-suite or for another business owner? Where can they start to really start making those changes and start thinking about it differently?
So the time frames are going to depend on the goals. I mean, that's straightforward. I think if you've got a long-term change in mind, it'll take a while. And most of these things, you know, most changes within an organization are going to take time to propagate. You know, you don't feel the effect of having made the change right away. It's going to move with some celerity, you know, through the business. It's okay to make an assumption around that. And again, we can test it. So we can ask ourselves how quickly, but based on our understanding of our culture, of how we disseminate information, of how, you know, how we operate, how people communicate, what do we expect? And then if we actually watch that happen, we can even ask ourselves, well, how do our assumptions about how we behave and how we think stack up against that? Has that surprised me? Would I like that to be faster? If I would like that to be faster, how can I make that happen? Because I think part of the promise with, particularly with AI coding, is how quickly can we iterate and prototype things, test them out, deploy them.
Yes.
If it's great, fantastic, let's improve it before we put it into production, but let's do that. If it's no good, scrap it, move on. But a lot of organizations, again, are kind of stuck at the manual deploy level, and they don't have good hygiene around deployments and rollbacks and so on. So going faster is just going to create more of a bottleneck. And so for leadership teams, a lot of where I start with people, first of all, there's a conversation to be had around what is AI really? What can it do for you? What can it not do? What are the risks? What are the benefits? Like, realistically, where in the organization do you want to deploy this? And I try and phrase it as things like, well, what do we want to do more of? And what do we want to do less of? Because I think that helps us move away from the conversation of, I want to cut our call center size by 80%, or I want to use AI to sift through CVs. Because I talk about things like, these are really fundamental, important things to do within an organization. If I'm going to add somebody to my organization, I want to be really, really confident they're the right person. And that means, you know, putting another human in front of them, right? I don't want to lose good candidates because I asked the machine to look at the CVs.
Yes.
Similarly, talking to my customers, I want my customers to have a great experience. What I don't want to do is have people put the phone down right away because they realize they're talking to a bot. But there's other things we can do there to assist people. And so I try and move us away from like just that straight up cost cutting measure to thinking about, like, you know, strategically, what kind of organization do we want to be? What do we want to achieve? Let's try and pull some levers and think about what those levers are. Where, what are some things that you couldn't imagine being feasible? Just put it all out there and I can be your expert in going through that list and going, well, this one's not really feasible even with today's AI. But you know, this one, enhancing the sort of information retrieval and the relevance of information for our operatives on the phone when our customers call, so that our customers A, talk to a person, but B, they get the information in a couple of minutes rather than, you know, 10 minutes being on hold. We can use technology to help humans deliver that service better. And not all of that is AI, right? Some of it is. Some of it might be. Some of it is just straight up good old data engineering and integration. A lot of it is people and process. You know, it's about understanding what are the processes that we execute in our organization in detail. Have we even measured some of these? In some places, have we even documented them? Do we know what they are? And then saying, look, what can we do to help our people perform better rather than what can we do to replace people?
And I think that's the case of what you're obviously in much bigger companies when you're dealing with the big tech, you hear these horror stories of, you know, the AI coming through and replacing. You're hearing a lot of layoffs in terms of it's shifting more of their budget towards AI. And you hear this, but for the medium, the small to medium businesses that are now building onto this, I think you get a more real approach on a real day-to-day approach as to what AI is kind of going through. And to the point of what you were mentioning on in terms of the financial piece of it, of you're having to look at one, change management, and what you've mentioned before, the documentation. Not everybody has a certain rollback in terms of if you have a disaster recovery or you need to like pull back to backups. You'd be surprised.
I got some real horror stories for you there for another day.
I imagine that, you know, with that, because we even had a client even beforehand of asking, should we move just because of the token management of how much things are causing, even for even GitHubs in terms of their cost is huge, right? Yeah. And so it might work for the solo developers or for the smaller teams, but when you compound and you're a much bigger organization, that's a different matter entirely. So from the thoughts of you working with on what you're seeing in the market right now, is it more into, do you suggest for clients to continue to go more on the enterprise AI, or what I'm hearing of, and let me know if you're hearing it, is moving more towards a open source where they're building their own AI to make sure that it's more compatible with their specific context? So if it's gathering all of their documentation from Confluence, or each team has it to where it keeps it internal, like, so have you seen that, or is it still moving towards?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's horses for courses in a way, right? I think everyone's been having great fun with the big sort of core AI players and their models and their products. And some of them are genuinely very interesting and very impressive, but very few of us have the capability to run those things in-house. So we are potentially reliant on a very small number of data centers in the world that are usually located in the United States or somewhere like it. And they're controlled by a very small number of people with a very particular set of values each. And organizations kind of come to me and they say, well, these things are really expensive. We're really concerned about things like data residency. We're also really concerned about buying an Elon Musk flavored AI or a Jeff Bezos flavored AI or a Mark Zuckerberg flavored AI, because we don't know what that means. Because none of these things are objective. It's really hard for organizations to think about the cost of testing them exhaustively, because if it's expensive to do the job once, it's going to be expensive to do the job 100 times and figure out what's the distribution of how it actually performs. So I think those are all really challenging questions for people. And lots of conversations that I've been having have been around sovereignty. So is it possible to deploy these things within the perimeter of the United Kingdom? And that has mixed results, because some vendors, I think all vendors really, have very limited capability. So you can ask for your model of choice to be deployed completely within the UK and sometimes within a specific data center, but that is really limited by the hardware they have available. And so people are saying, well, I'm stuck on GPT-4, 4 point something, you know, 4.2 or 4.3, because that's all that this vendor can deploy. And the same is true in Azure. The same is true in AWS. I don't use GCP that much anymore, but I haven't tried to geo-restrict that. But those are the kind of things that people see. And people are concerned about data residency. It's becoming increasingly problematic. I mean, we've seen in the last few weeks, we've seen the US government sort of cut off access to models. And so if you are using that and you're building your business around it, and it becomes really crucial to have access to a specific model from a specific vendor, and access to that disappears overnight and doesn't come back, what do you do? And so I also talk about resilience around that as well. So building not just for one model, not hyper-optimizing on one model, but thinking about, actually, have you tested this with 4 or 5 different things? And what are the different cost behaviors? What are the different performance outcomes for these? Do you need different prompts with them? What happens if you use the same prompts with them? And big businesses have the opportunity to generate lots of data from those questions, because they can do sampling and all, you know, they've got enough staff doing enough work to make that tractable. Small businesses do not. They're sort of in the fire once and move on mode with this.
Yeah.
And they're also in the FOMO stage of, well, if I don't do this, my competitor next door is going to do this. So I'd better get on with it. So these are all like really challenging questions to try and unpack with people and go, well, how can we measure this? You know, if we want to think about how much this has cost to create this piece of code, this asset, can we put a number on it? And then people have also started to come to me now around things like ESG. So they will want to know, what's the environmental cost of the work that I'm doing? What's the greenhouse gas emissions equivalent of this piece of code that I've just generated that I have to put in my, you know, my Scope 3 emissions statement as a business?
Really? You're seeing that a lot? They're getting questions on that?
People are now starting to ask those questions. Yeah. Smaller businesses, not so. But if you're a supplier to a bigger business, then yes, that's now starting to happen. And the governance question comes up. So what are you doing to ensure that there is no data leakage into these systems? Do you know what the data flows are? And I see very few organizations putting actual hard barriers in between humans and data and AI interfaces.
What do you mean by that? Break that down. I'm curious about that.
So by which I mean, what I see an awful lot of IT departments deploying Copilot, or the equivalent of sending out an email to everybody saying, congratulations, you've now got Copilot. Please don't put any confidential data in it. Because what they haven't done is put a layer in between.
Control layer.
To essentially say, oh, this user looks like they're trying to put a social security number in. Let's either block that or mask it, or do something clever like mask it, retain the value, and then when it comes back. Because there are products on the market now that do that, which is great. But I see most organizations are just nowhere near that level of sophistication. It's buying Copilot licenses. It's buying Claude Code licenses still.
Yeah. And so it's even insane. And I think that, do you think that the now in this term, especially now with agentic now you can have the AI be essentially quote unquote like a little bit of a employee in a sense, it can limit to the process. Do you think now in this, what we're seeing now in the environment is now around governance of how to govern the AI, or is it still just on just how to even break in and just how to utilize it properly? Going back to your original questions of what are the initiatives that we need to utilize, or is it now it's more focused on control and how is that control plan? What is the security around that? What's around the Active Directory or the intro, depending on whatever cloud platform that you're on or on-prem?
So lots of organizations are still scrabbling around trying to find use cases. They've had a play. They like it. They don't like it, whatever. But they're saying, right, where can I actually deploy this that's going to make a meaningful difference? And I think they haven't done what I would recommend, which is an explicit kind of back of the packet cost benefit analysis, but they've done it implicitly. And so there's that doubt in their mind of, is this even worth it? And then on top of that, I think I'm seeing remarkably few businesses go into that governance piece. So some are talking about it. So organizations, like big organizations here, some of them will say the adoption of AI is done. We've done it. Success. Excellent. You know, mission complete banner behind me. And I know from talking to the people in those organizations actually on the ground doing the work, what that means is that they've just been handed a license. And then the CIO has walked away from it. And they're sat there going, well, but surely it's my job on the line. If I accidentally paste something into Copilot and it leaves the organization, I'm personally liable for that. So there's an element of the technical in that, which is, are there actual barriers and controls in place to protect people and the organization and customers or patients or whatever it is? There's also the good old like human processes and documentation and training, which just hasn't been done yet. And so those all, you know, those organizations are saying, well, we've done deployment. Now we're going into governance, but it doesn't seem to be happening in the same way. And I'm really, you know, obviously I see things mostly from a UK perspective. I do see quite a few overseas organizations as well, but mostly UK. And I think we are quite behind the curve in some respects compared to where we understand the US to be. I'm not sure that's necessarily a bad thing. I think we've been skeptical and I think we've been late to the party in a very British way. But I do wonder if, because some of the kind of air has gone out of the bubble a bit now, is that going to place us just slightly better now for picking this up and running with it?
So I'm curious. So with it being on your thoughts around it in terms of the international markets, what do you think is like the best few steps that you should get started on to getting more online? Because as you said, it's not necessarily a bad thing that it's behind the curve, but because now you can adjust, pivot, and go forward. So what are the first three things that you've seen from other companies and what has worked that they can start implementing on international markets, I'd say?
What has worked? Yeah, that's a challenging thing. So it's got to be, if you're going to use this technology directly to service customers or something like that, it really has to be something, I think, that you wouldn't otherwise be capable of doing. So it's not just a case of, oh, we could do this if we had more software developers. We could do this if we had more analysts. I think to really get the benefit, it's got to be something completely outside the box. That's why we have that conversation around, well, what are the things you've always dreamed about doing? What are the real problems in this industry that no one's actually addressing because it's too hard? And if we unpack that, are the blockers to that something that we could resolve with AI? So I think, you know, you and I have sort of slipped into what always happens with these conversations is we end up talking about language models, when actually this is a really broad family of very loosely grouped together technologies.
It is.
And, you know, there is a conversation to be had around, do people always need to reach for the same tool? Because, you know, the last generation of natural language tools, also very good and much more tractable to train and deploy your own for specific purposes, is what you need actually just a bit of machine learning or an expert system. Or for a lot of organizations, it's just a big if-then-else type decision tree, right? It doesn't have to be something that's stochastically generating a set of actions it's going to execute autonomously. So I find that a really challenging conversation to have with people. Like, what do you dream of doing? You know, what's the big thing in your industry that no one's cracked yet? Could we do that?
And I think you brought up that conversation before, just on that I've heard you say before, is just on, is the company ready for enterprise AI, right? Is there a readiness assessment for that? Is that, I think that's what I've heard as well. It's just, are companies really ready to utilize it properly? Is it forward? Or is it just getting compared by the hype?
So I get asked to do a lot of things like readiness assessments of one degree or another. And you do the classic consultant thing of you look at the current state, you work with them to understand what they think their use cases and potential future values are. You rank those in some way, you do a feasibility assessment, and you come out with some sort of hopefully risk-based rationale that says, yes, no, proceed, don't proceed. These are the top three. Off we go. Those are quite useful. And I do think they're really great for explaining to businesses, especially if you're trying to get information. I was saying before about the divide between leadership and execution. They're quite good for surfacing stuff up to the top of the organization. because 9 times out of 10, it's the bottom layer screaming, saying,
yes,
we can't do this. Like, this isn't going to work. Don't put any more stuff on us because it will just break. So I think that's quite useful. But if people really grasp the nettle with an activity like that and they really engage with it honestly and authentically, that's that cultural piece as well. I think this is a really great opportunity for going right back to the beginning of why does our organization work the way it does? Why does it operate the way it does? Are we just doing this because that's the way we've always done things? Well, now it might be a heck of a lot easier to completely re-engineer this organization. There's still risk in doing that, obviously, but the level of like software engineering required, the level of data engineering required, the number of people required, all of those things, the equations are different.
And I can imagine as you're going through, because they get so, it's such big questions, like what do we need to do? How are we seeing from the current state and what's the future state? And you're dealing with different stakeholders. So if I'm in a C-suite, or if I'm coming on as a new CTO that's coming on to a company, and I have to bring this forward onto the next steps, where should we really look at in terms of how do we break that down into smaller chunks and to such a big box and breaking it down to really show improvement, or to really showcase, hey, we're making somewhat of a traction here. We're pulling in more data. We're seeing things differently.
So one of the things I would emphasize with people is I'm not sure it makes sense in organizations to think of AI as a separate strand by itself. Do you need an AI strategy? Do you need an AI enablement team and all of that? Maybe, but actually at the strategic level, the process and the scale of it hasn't changed, because you're still having those big conversations around what does the organization aim to be? What's it going to do? What are the big levers to pull? AI kind of comes into there as an enabler to say, well, if we want to, I don't know, let's pick something slightly material. We want to improve the return on our advertising spend by 20%. Classic problem. Great. Well, how might AI help us do that? Let's be open-minded about asking that question. Let's ideate a bunch of ways it might help us, or ways that it might not help us, but ideally the former. And then we can start to analyze each one of those in turn and say, well, we've got 10 different ways this could help us. We could do image generation. We could do video. We could do audio. But that's just doing what we already do bigger or faster or cheaper, whatever those things are. But actually, how might we turn this on its head? How could we analyze data differently? How could we integrate data differently? What does marketing kind of mean when you've got things like language models on the case? If people are finding information about businesses through these tools, well, what do we have to do to get ourselves promoted? How do we have to behave differently or write differently or publish differently? Who do we engage with in order to get that boost? So I think there's a few different levers we can pull. And I think one of the mistakes organizations have been making is, I think we're with the data strategy, with the AI strategy, but actually those things are important, but they're kind of transverse, aren't they? And they're part of, well, we've got a marketing strategy and we've got a product strategy, and that feeds into our overarching business strategy, but we need a slice of data that runs all the way through, and we need a slice of AI that runs all the way through, just in the same way that we need a slice of IT that runs all the way through. So I think the danger is that people will and are going hard on needing AI right now, just AI for AI's sake.
So it kind of gets into the point of just on, because you're having to deal with, you're bringing in AI, I see it a lot with other clients, you're bringing on AI for the sake of AI, but how is it really justifying to what we are, whether it's in lead generation, whether it's, you might have some in your IT perspective, like, oh, this can help with our operation velocity and again, building it faster. But in terms of the different areas of the business, it doesn't really showcase that. And you've really brought that piece in. How do we have it? Is it for image generation? Is it for the posting for lead gen, on bringing people in? How are we assessing that? To your point of search engine optimization, now you can have it for Google's, to have it to where you have summaries of the businesses. How do we adjust that? I think as time goes on, as these systems become more influenced, do you think that's the main approach on how the business decision makers should move towards on how do we reverse engineer this? How can we make this better? Can AI make this better?
let's think about what these kind of tools are good at as well. You know, if we think about them as optimizers, you could set an organizational level goal around profitability or whatever it is. And you may set some instructions to this AI orchestration layer around, here are some of the controls, here are some of the levers that you can pull to make that happen. And then you can have, you know, those agents and those people harmonize together across those different verticals, putting those different ideas into operation. And then maybe the really interesting bit is, rather than trying to optimize each one of those pillars independently and having humans, you know, very poorly communicate with each other about, well, I'm doing this and you're doing that, and well, now my data pipelines are broken because you put a VPN in this country, all of those things. If you could put a layer of AI communication in between those things, maybe that simplifies all of that. And actually, the complexity of having to communicate all of this information all of the time just gets that much easier. The friction of having to do that lessens. And then there's the question of, like, what will humans do if we're not writing emails to each other all the time? You know, we would probably spend a lot of time looking at what actually are the processes that are being executed, because I'm no longer buried in having to execute that process. What does that look like? Is it efficient? Could it be more efficient? Where does it integrate? What's going wrong? So I think those are some interesting things to ponder about when we talk about what does an organization full of AI and AI agents look like. I think it probably looks like that at the moment.
So, and I have it to where, and to your point of it, it's how much time can we get back from it? Because you hear there's a lot of repetitive, that's the whole point of the automation piece, right? Of workers that are doing documentation or for data entry. And I think you're seeing a little bit of that from the bigger LLMs, right? Of like, now you can integrate Claude with Slack now, so where it can communicate team. So it's a lot more integrated rather than its individual pieces. It brings on, as you said before, that brainstorming piece, and now it's integrating with the larger team rather than just a single individual. And I see that. And then for the other piece of it as well is, to your point of it, how can, and I think this is where I usually go more towards for folks that are really hesitant of AI and taking jobs, because if it can save 45 minutes or even 30 minutes a day of what you can do, then you can utilize that time to brainstorm, how can I make my job even easier or better? How can I provide more value to my role or to the business?
I think eventually people will be able to do that. I think at the moment, what I do see from people is they get maybe a little bit of time back in the day, and they just, completely fairly to them, they just take that time to just decompress a bit. Because I do rather think we're living in a world where everybody is, you know, just working flat out all of the time.
Yes.
Under a lot of pressure. And the minute that pressure can get lifted a little bit, I think that's very helpful to people. But I think part of the challenge with where we are right now with these sorts of technologies is people find it very hard to look beyond time savings as what this can do for you. And therefore, you know, that not only makes your business case usually really hard to justify for a lot of businesses, because the savings are small. But the other side of the equation that you mentioned, which is, what could you do that you couldn't do before? Is there something in your organization that you just really want to do that you were never able to do? So that's potentially a top level question. But as you say, you expect, I don't know about you, but when you go and talk to factory workers on the floor, you know, warehouse workers, and everyone is full of like, well, this could be better, or that process could be better, and we had this many, you know, defects, and we could reduce that if we did X, Y, and Z. I just don't have the time and capacity to make that happen.
Okay.
So there's a cultural shift involved with that, because we need to, as managers, we need to be able to trust our teams,
yes,
to know what is best, or at least know what might be best. Have the resources, the confidence, the risk management to enable people to try that. Have the measurement set up so that we can actually evidence the result and communicate that to other people and go, you know what, this warehouse over here now operates completely differently from all the other warehouses in the firm. But that's because this particular group of people found a particular issue in their organization that is completely local to them, and they've tweaked that. Now, that doesn't mean that tweak is actually relevant to any of the other operations. It's just completely unique to this singular unit, but it's within our risk envelope. So we are comfortable with that. And we've enabled the team to kind of take that forward by themselves. And I actually think that's quite unusual I think that would be quite a different mode of operation for a lot of businesses that actually think they need uniformity and compliance from everybody.
And I think that, do you see that that's part of the disconnect of where you're seeing from the executive level down to where on the day-to-day workers, what you're saying is that's a big part?
I would say more than one person has been very excited about the prospect of the amount of additional control they will have over people if they are watching what people are doing all of the time in excruciating levels of detail, which I sort of think is getting away from the real value, right? I mean, we want to unlock and empower and democratize those lofty goals, maybe. But I actually think we're probably closer to it with this set of technologies than we were with data. Because turns out, even if data is democratized, it still requires a lot of very specialist skills to make it work. But almost anybody can write a natural language prompt for a tool with that sort of interface, or even speak to it, if that's the way we're going.
Yeah. So, you know, with that, Alex, so what do you see? And before, you know, we kind of come off, because this has been, I really appreciated just your insight into it. What do you see in the market? Because so much has shifted in the last year in terms of it. So where is your prediction on how the trending of how the market is in terms of how AI is applied, how it's the new features, and just what's it going to be able to do by just this time next year for even as yourself as a consultant dealing with it? What's your prediction?
I don't like making predictions, Solomon. In sort of climate science, we try and avoid that word wherever possible. We use words like projections and scenarios
trending,
and things.
I guess it's
exactly. I mean, the reality with these with LLMs particularly, and these types of deep learning based models, is they are constrained by the amount of data that goes into them. They are constrained by the algorithms that are used to train them, the technology that is the hardware it runs on. What I would really like to see is greater efficiency, computational efficiency from these things. So running models on lighter hardware with the same level of performance, but also smaller models basically as well with a good enough level of performance. So I am a big fan of running a lot of things locally. I do most of my work for myself and my business on my laptop, which is great. And I write all my own agents and things like that. And I think, you know, we'll see more and more small businesses will go down that route, because the small models can now do quite a lot of stuff that is just generally helpful.
Yes.
Analyze a document, write some text, proofread something, you know, the simple things that people find helpful. Where I think it will actually go, I gave a talk about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, to an innovation group about whether or not I think AI is a bubble, is a market bubble or not. And what do I think happens after that bubble deflates or it pops? And I put my hat on a peg and said, I do think it's a bubble. I think there's lots of evidence to suggest that it is a bubble. Here it is. And where are we in the UK with that right now? Well, we're already at the stage where data centers aren't getting built. You know, they're getting either blocked at planning stage, or they get approved and they go nowhere, because the economics of actually building the thing and running it just don't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And we're partly there because the UK has very expensive electricity and very expensive land and all those things. But we're also there because demand just hasn't taken off. So there is a slight chicken and egg thing with that. But a big part of it in the UK is trust. Most people do not trust these technologies, and they do not trust the companies that make them.
Even here in the US, it's the same.
So I think we will start to see in the UK more homegrown AI businesses. The government has already started to pour money into that initiative. And I think once we start to see things like language models pop out and such and so forth, we might start to see a bit more of an uptake. But I think it's going to require that it's got to be coupled with that more efficient use of compute and storage.
Yeah, I think I know we're go on, Tom, because I could go on and on, because I think you're starting to see that, Alex, is, you know, with, you know, local ages more on with Hermes, and then you're dealing with Llama on that side of where you can build out more. And then if you really want to get really good, you can add it in a container, and then you can kind of build it from a container. It's pretty impressive.
And look, like, we're at the stage where you can run a pretty decent model on a Raspberry Pi. And get decent results. And you could even run it in Kubernetes on a Raspberry Pi cluster if you really wanted to. And apart from the fact that Raspberry Pis have become astronomically expensive at the moment, like, that's much more achievable for a small business than buying an NVIDIA appliance or even buying a GPU.
Yes.
So I think those things are quite interesting. I think we are starting to see, you know, when we talk about bubbles deflating or bursting, and you mentioned GitHub and changes to pricing structures and so on at the beginning, I think we're only going to see more of that because some of these organizations are now under enormous pressure to start to be profitable, and they are nowhere near profitable. So I suspect we'll start to see the screws turned on them a bit there. I think a consumption-based pricing model at high pricing is going to just stop adoption even further.
I'm curious to really just see how it is, because now it's shifting with Fable moving more towards, they've been pushing it out more now towards API cost, and you're really seeing it. So I think it is. I'd love to kind of bring you on in the next kind of a couple of months later just to see on how the changes have been on that.
Yeah. I mean, we're just kind of throwing things out there. I mean, when I talk about things like AI and bubbles bursting and stuff, I genuinely expected a lot of pushback from the audience around, you're a Luddite, that kind of feedback. And the audience wasn't there at all. They were saying, yeah, we kind of see those signals too. We thought the SpaceX IPO was a real kind of red flag. What should we do? Should we think about getting an appliance in-house? Should we pull back the amount of money that we're investing in AI? Should we think about doing local deployments? So I think people are kind of thinking about these things in their business planning.
And I think so. So Alex, it was so great to have you on and it just learn more. I know we're a little bit over, but it's just, you brought so much different insight into it, just with you being on the consultative side and on the data modeling. I'm just so, especially just on the international market, what you're seeing in Britain. So thank you for coming on. So for folks that are wanting to learn more about you and that want to know more on your independent consulting, where can they find you? Where can they come to even ask questions if necessary? They want to go forward.
So there are two ways that I think it's best to try and find me. The first one is my company's website, which is Hecaton Consulting, HECATON.consulting. The second one is LinkedIn, sadly, the only social network that I think I'm still on. Yeah. I am one of two Alex Leithards in the world, I think. And so you should be able to find me pretty easily on there. I would encourage anyone who has a question, has a thought, disagrees with anything that I've said and would like a chat about it, please, you know, reach out and get in touch. I'd love to hear from you.
No, and then for the audience listening in, we'll make sure to have all of Hecaton's Consulting's details, Alex's info, so you could be able to reach out, ask any questions of that. We'd love to have that. So the last thing for you, Alex, for the CEO listening in, what would be the first thing right now? What would be a strong first thing to do within a, let's say, in a 3-month period, what they should start with first to get those measurable improvement? What would be the one big thing you would say?
You've got to set the conditions for success. You've got to set the conditions for that measurement of improvement. So what are, you know, what's the why? What's the big levers you're going to pull, and what's your baseline?
I love that. For those that are coming on, thanks again for tuning into the AI Advantage. We'll catch you next week. We'll check out with a new guest to speak on. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the AI Advantage. If this episode sparked an idea, share it with your network. Subscribe for more no fluff conversations on how smart tech drives real outcomes. And if you're ready to future-proof your business, let's connect at SolonOps.net.